Muhammad Rasulullah, the Apostle of Mercy, by Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi. Chapter 2, The Selection of Arabia for the Advent of Prophet Muhammad. It was the will of God that the glorious sun of humanity's guidance, which was to illuminate the world without end, should rise from the orb of Arabia. For it was the darkest corner of this terrestrial globe. It needed the most radiant day star to dispel the gloom setting on it. God had chosen the Arabs as the standard bearers of Islam for propagating its message to the four corners of the world. Since these guideless people were simple-hearted, nothing was inscribed on the tables and the tablets of their mind and heart, nothing so engraven that was deep so as to present any difficulty in sweeping the slate clean of any impression. The Romans, the Iranians, and the Indians, instinctively thrilled by the glory of their ancient arts and literature, philosophies, culture, civilization, were all crushed by a heavy burden of the past, that is, an conditioned reflex of touch-me-notism had got itself etched in their minds. The imprints in the memory of the Arabs were lightly impressed, merely because of their rawness and ignorance, or rather than their nomadic life, that they were liable to be obliterated easily and replaced by new inscriptions. They were, in modern phraseology, suffering from unperceptiveness, which could readily be remedied, while other civilized nations, having vivid pictures of the past fill their minds, were haunted by an obsessively increased irrationality which could never be dismissed from their thoughts. The Arabs, simple-minded, straightforward, possessed the will of iron. They failed to entertain the belief. They had no hesitation in taking up the sword to fight against it. But if they were convinced of the truth of an idea, they stayed with it through fire and water and were prepared to lay down their lives for that idea or belief. It was this psyche of the Arab mind which had found expression through Suhail bin Amr, while the Amritize of Hudaybiyah was to be written. The document began with the words, "This is what Muhammad, the Apostle of God, had agreed." Suhail promptly raised the objection, "By God, if I witnessed that you were the Apostle of God, I would have not excluded you from the house of God or fought you." Again, it was the same Arab turn of mind which is reflected in the summons of Ikrimah bin Abu Jahl. Pressed hard by the assailing charge of the Byzantinian forces, he cried out, "What a dolt you are! I have wielded the sword against the Apostle of God. Will I turn my back upon you?" Thereafter, he called out his comrades, "Is there anyone to take the pledge of death on my hands?" Several people immediately offered themselves and fought valiantly until they were all maimed and died a heroic death. The Arabs were frank and unassuming, practical and sober, industrious and plain-spoken. They were neither double dealers nor liked to be caught in a trap. Like a people true-souled, they were always outspoken and remained firm once they had taken a decision. An incident occurring before the Hijrah of the Prophet on occasion of the second pledge of Aqaba typically illustrates the character of the Arabs. Ibn Ishaq relates that when Aus and Khazraj plighted their faith to the Prophet at Aqaba, Abbas bin Ubaidah of Khazraj said to the people, "O men of Khazraj, do you realize to what you are committing yourselves and pledging your support to the Prophet? It is to wage war against one and all. If you think that is the case, you will lose your property and your nobles and are killed. You will give him up to the enemies, then do not do so. For God, it will bring shame in this world and in the next. If you have decided that you will be true to your words, if your property is destroyed and your nobles are killed, then pledge yourselves, for by God, it would bring you profit and success both in this world and the next." The Khazraj replied, "We will pledge our support, even if we lose our property and our leaders are killed. But the Apostle of God, what will we get in return for redeeming our pledge?" The Prophet said, "Paradise." Thereupon they said, "Stretch forth your hand," and when the Prophet did so, they took their oath of allegiance. And in truth and reality, the Ansar lived up to their word of honor. The reply given to the Prophet on the subsequent occasion by Sa'd ibn Mu'az perfectly expressed their feelings. Sa'd said to the Prophet, O Prophet of God, if you continue your march and get as far as Barq al-Ghimad, we would accompany you, and if you were to cross the sea, we would plunge into the sea with you. My Lord, this ocean has interrupted my march, although I wanted to go ahead and proclaim your name in all the lands and the seas, were the words uttered despairingly by Uqba bin Nafi on reaching the shore of the Atlantic Ocean. What Uqba said on finding his victorious advances blocked by the ocean speaks volume of the seriousness and the absolute trust, the iron will of the Arabs in accomplishing a task considered truthful by them. The Greeks, the Byzantinians, the Iranians were people of a different metal. They were accustomed to improving the shining hour as a God-spent opportunity. They lacked the grit to fight against injustice and brutality. No ideal, no principle was attractive enough for them. No conviction or call was sufficiently potent to tug at their heartstrings in a way that they could imperil their comfort and pleasure. Unspoiled by the nicety, polish, usually produced by the display of wealth and luxury of an advanced culture, the Arabs had not developed that fastidiousness which hardens the heart and makes the brain sterile. It allows no emotion to catch the flame and always acts as an inhibition when one's faith or conviction demands the stirring of the blood. This is at the listless apathy which is hardly ever erased from one's heart. Candidly honest and true soul, the Arabs had no taste for intrigue and duplicity. They were courageous fighters, accustomed by a simple and hard life filled with dangers, and spent most of their time riding on horsebacks across the desert. These were the rules of iron, essential for a nation, required to accomplish a great task, especially in an age when adventure and enterprise were the laws of the Persians and the Romans. The common ignorance of the Arabs, exempted from the shame and reproach it involves, had helped to conserve the natural briskness and intellectual energy of these people. Being strangers to philosophy and sophisticated words, lame and impotent quabbling, they had preserved their soundness of their mind, dispatch and resoluteness and fervidness of their spirit. The perpetual independence of Arabia from the yoke of invaders had made the Arabs free as birds. They enjoyed the benefit of human equality, the beauty of living nature, and they were not acquainted with the pomp and majesty or the naughty and haughty demeanor of the empires. The servile temper of the ancient Persia had, contrarily, exalted the Sassanids monarchy to supernatural beings. If any king took a medicine or was given any medicine, a proclamation was made in the capital that all and sundry should suspend their trades and business on that day. If the king sneezed, nobody should raise his voice to say grace, or was anybody expected to say Ameen when the king sent up a prayer. The day any king paid a visit to any noble or chief was regarded an event so memorable that the elated family of fortunate grandee instituted a new calendar from that day. It was an honor so singular that the grandee was exempted from the payment of tax for a fixed period, besides enjoying other rewards, which are fiefs and robes of honor. We can imagine what a state audience of the king must have been like for those who were allowed to appear before him. By etiquette, all the courtiers, even the highest nobles and dignitaries, were required to stand silently with their hands folded on the navel and their heads bowed in reverence. Actually, this was a ceremonial etiquette prescribed by the state audience during the reign of Kisra I. One can very easily visualize the pompous ceremonies in vague during the reign of Sassanid kings, justly reputed as tyrants and despots. Freedom of speech and expression and not censure or criticism in the least, was a luxury never indulged in by anyone in the vast kingdom of the Sassanids, the Persians. Christensen has related on the authority of Tabari a story about Kisra I, passing under the name of the Just amongst the Sassanid kings, which demonstrates the freedom of expression allowed by the Iranian kings and the price paid for the imprudence of speaking out the truth. Quote, he assembled his council and ordered the secretary for taxes to be read loud and the new rates for collection. When the secretary had announced the taxes, Kisra I asked twice whether anyone had any objection to the new arrangement. Everybody remained silent, but on the third time, a man stood up and asked respectfully whether the king had meant to establish a tax for perpetuity on things perishable, which at the time went on, could lead to injustice. Accursed and crash, cried the king. To what class do you belong? I am one of the secretaries, he replied. Then, ordered the king, beat him to death with pen cases. Thereupon, every secretary started beating him with pen cases until the poor man died, and the beholder exclaimed, O king, we find all the taxes you have levied upon us just and fair. Unquote. The horrible condition of the depressed classes in the then India, who were condemned as untouchables by social and religious law, promulgated by the Aryans, baffles all human understanding. Subjugated to gruesome indignity, this unfortunate class of human beings was treated pretty much the same way as animals, except that they resemble the species of man. According to this law, a Shudra who assaulted a Brahmin or attempted to do so was to lose a limb with which the assault was made. The Shudra was forced to drink boiling oil if he made pretentious claim of teaching somebody. The penalty for killing dogs, cats, frogs was the same as that for killing a Shudra. Unworthy treatment of their subjects by the Sassanid emperors had been not a lot of the common man in Byzantine, but in their pride and policy to display the titles and attributes of their omnipresence, the Caesars of Rome had all the signs of their Oriental counterparts. Victor Chopart writes about the arbitrary rule and majesty of the Roman emperors. The Caesars were gods, but not by hereditary, and one who rose to power would become divine in this turn, and thus there was no mark by which he could be recognized in advance. The transmission of the title of Augustus was governed by no regular constitutional law. It was acquired by victory over rivals, and the Senate did no more than ratify the decisions of arms. This ominous fact became apparent in the first century of the Principate, which was merely a continuance of military dictatorship. Unquote. If we compare the servile submission of the common man of Byzantine and Persia with the spirit of freedom and pride, as well as the temperament and social conduct of the pre-Islamic Arabs, we would see the difference between the social life and the natural propensities of the Arabs and other nations of the world. May you be safe from frailty and wish you a happy morning were some of the salutations very often used by the Arabs to hail their kings. So solicitous were they of preserving their dignity and pride, honor and freedom, that many a time they even refused to satisfy the demand of their chiefs or the rulers. A story preserved by Arab historians admirably describes the rudimentary Arab virtues of courage and outspokenness. An Arab king demanded a mare known as Sikab from its owner, belonging to Banu Tamim, that is the tribe of Umar ibn al-Khattab. The man just refused flatly the request and instantly indicted a poem of which the opening lines were, Sikab is a nice mare, good as gold, too precious to be gifted or sold. And in the concluding verse he says, to grab it from me, make no effort, for I am competent to balk your attempt. The virtue common to all Arabs, men and women, were overweening pride, loftiness of ambition, chivalrous bearing, and magnanimous generosity, and a wild spirit of freedom. We find all these features of Arab character depicted in the affairs leading to the murder of Amr ibn Hind, the king of Hira. It was related that Amr ibn Hind once sent to Amr ibn Kulthum, the proud cavalier and noted poet of Banu Taghlib, inviting him to pay a visit to himself and also to bring his mother Layla bint Muhallil to visit his own mother. Amr came to Hira from Jazeera with some of his friends, and Layla came attended by a number of her women. Pavilions were erected between Hira and the Euphrates. In one of these pavilions, Amr bin Hind entertained Amr bin Kulthum, while Layla found quarters with Hind in an adjoining tent. Now, Amr bin Hind had already instructed his mother to dismiss the servants before calling for dessert and thus cause Layla to wait upon her. Accordingly, Hind sent off her servants at the appointed moment and asked her guest, "O Layla, hand me the dish." Layla felt insulted and exclaimed in shame, "Let those who want anything fetch it for themselves." Hind insisted on her demand despite Layla's refusal. At last, Layla cried, "Oh shame, health, taqlik, health." Amr bin Kulthum got up his blood on hearing his mother's cry, seizing a sword hanging on the wall, smote the king dead with a single blow. At the same time, the tribesmen of Banu Taghlib ransacked the tent and made several rapid strides back to Jazeera. Amr bin Kulthum has narrated the story in an ode, which is a fine illustration of the pre-Islamic deal of chivalry. It was included in a significant book called The Seven Suspended Odes. The same Arab tradition of democracy, tempered by aristocracy, is to be witnessed in the meeting between the Arab envoy Mughira bin Shaba and Rustam, the Sassanian general and administrator of the empire. When Mughira entered the splendid court of Rustam, he found the latter sitting on a throne. Mughira made his way directly to Rustam, as was the Arab tradition, and sat down on the throne by the side of Rustam. Rustam's courtiers, however, lost no time in getting Mughira down from the throne of their chief. Thereupon, Mughira said, "We had heard that you are a sagacious people, but now I see that none of you are more blockheaded than you. We Arabs treat everyone equally and enslave no man except in the battlefield. I had presumed that you would be conducting yourself similarly towards your own people. You should have better told us that you have exalted some amongst you as your gods, for we would have then known that no dialogue was possible between you and us. If in that case we would not have dealt with you in the way that we have done or come to see you, although it was you who invited us here." Unquote. There are yet another reason for the advent of the last prophet in Arabia, and it was the Kaaba, the house of God, built by Ibrahim alayhi salam and Ismail at the center for worship of one God. As is said in the Quran, "Lo, the first sanctuary appointed for mankind was at Bakka, a blessed place, a guidance for the people." Unquote. There is a mention of the Valley of Bakka in the Old Testament. The old translators of the Bible gave this word the meaning a valley of weeping, but better sense seems to have prevailed later on. According to more recent biblical scholars, the word signifies rather a valley lacking water, and the Palmites apparently have in mind a particular valley whose natural condition led them to adopt that name. Now, this waterless valley, which was easily to be identified with the Valley of Makkah, has been mentioned in the Book of Palm. Quote, "Blessed are they that dwell in your house. They will still be praising you, Selah. Blessed is the man whose strength is in you, in whose heart are the ways of them who passing through the Valley of Bakka make it a well." Unquote. The birth of Prophet Muhammad, on whom be peace, in the city of Makkah was really an answer to the prayer sent by Ibrahim and Ismail while laying the foundation of Makkah. They had prayed to their Lord in the following words, "O Lord, and raise up unto them an apostle from amongst them who shall recite unto them your revelations and teach them the book and wisdom and shall cleanse them. Verily you are the mighty, the wise." Unquote. The standing norm of God Almighty is that He always answers the prayers of those who are pious and devoted and pure in heart. The Apostle of God, occupy, without doubt, a higher place than the most devout and the godliest believers. All the earlier scriptures and prophecies bear witness to this fact. Even the Old Testament testifies that the supplication of Ibrahim in regards to Ismail met an approval from God. The book of Genesis says, quote, "And for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation." Unquote. That is why the prophet reported to have said, quote, "I am the result of prayer of Ibrahim and the prophecy of Jesus Christ." Unquote. The Old Testament still contains, notwithstanding its numerous alterations, the evidence that this prayer of Ibrahim was answered by God. Mark the very clear reference in the book of Deuteronomy to the advent of the prophet. Quote, "The Lord your God will raise up unto you a prophet from the midst of you, of your brethren, like unto me, unto him you shall reckon." Unquote. Now, this being a prognosis by Moses, your brethren, clearly indicates that the prophet promised by God was to be raised from amongst the Ishmaelites, who were the cousins of the Israelites. God again reiterates his promise in the same book. Quote, "And the Lord said unto me, they have well spoken that which they have spoken. I will raise them up a prophet from amongst their brothers, like unto you, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I have, I shall command him." Unquote. The words, "put my words in his mouth," occurring in this oracle, clearly indicate that the advent of the prophet was to recite and deliver to the people the divine revelations exactly as he received them from angel Jibrail. This prediction was sustained by the Quran as well. Quote, "Nor does he speak on his own desire." Unquote. Again, the Quran says about the revelation vouchsafed to the prophet. Quote, "Falsehood cannot come at it from before it or behind it. It is a revelation from the wise, the owner of praise." Unquote. But quite unlike the Quran, both the Bible and its followers ascribe the authorship of the books included in the Bible to ancient sages and to great teachers, and never to divine author God himself. Modern biblical scholars have reached the conclusion that, quote, "Ancient Jewish traditions attributed the authorship of the Penashush, with the exceptions of the last 8 verses describing Moses' death, to Moses himself. But the most inconsistencies and seemingly contradictory passages contained in it attracted the attention of the rabbis, who exercised their ingenuity in reconciling them." Unquote. As for the books forming a part of the New Testament, they had never been treated, either literally or in their contents, to be of divine origin. These books really contain a bibliographical account and anecdotes of Jesus as narrated by the latter scribes, rather than a book of revelation sent on to Jesus Christ from his master. We now have come to the geographical position of Arabia, which, being connected by land and sea routes with the continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe, occupied the most suitable place for being chosen as the center of enlightenment for radiating divine guidance and knowledge to the entire world. All the 3 continents have been cradles of great civilization and powerful empires, while Arabia lay in the center, through which passed the merchandise of all countries far and near, affording an opportunity to different nations and races for exchange of thoughts and ideas. 2 great empires, the Persian and the Byzantinian Empire, on either side of the Arabian Peninsula, governed the history of the world. Both were large, rich, powerful, and both fought each other constantly. Yet Arabia jealously guarded her independence and never allowed either of the 2 powers to lay its hands on it, bearing a few territories lying on its frontiers. Excepting a few tribes, the Arabs of the desert were extremely sensitive to this regal dignity and untrammeled freedom, and he never allowed any despot to hold him in bondage. Such a country, unimpeded by political and social constraints, was ideally suited to become the nucleus of the universal message preaching human equality, liberty, and dignity. For all these reasons, God selected Arabia and the city of Makkah within Arabia for the advent of the Prophet, to whom divine scripture was to be sent for the last time to pave way for the proclamation of peace throughout the length and the breadth of the world from age to age. As is said in the Quran, Allah knows best with whom to place his message. Unquote. Arabia's era of depression. For this manly qualities of head and heart, the Arabs deserved, or were rather the only people entitled to the honor of the advent of the last prophet of God amongst them, and to be made responsible for the propagation of the message of Islam. But in no part of the peninsula was there any indication of any awakening or vexation of the spirit, showing the sign of life left in the Arabs. They were scarcely a few Hanif, who could be, Hanif are people who worship one God, who could be counted on one's fingers, feeling their way towards monotheism, but they were no more than glowworms in a dark, chilly, rainy night, incapable of showing the path of righteousness to anybody or providing warmth to one who is frozen to death. This was an era of darkness and deprivation in the history of Arabia, a period of the darkest gloom, when the country had reached the rock bottom of its putrefied decadence, leaving no hope of any reform or improvement. The shade of things in Arabia presented a task far more formidable and baffling than faced by any other messenger of God. Sir William Moir, a biographer of the Prophet, who is ever willing to find fault with the Prophet and cast reflections upon him, has vividly depicted the state of affairs in Arabia before the birth of the Prophet, which discredits the view held by certain European Orientalists that Arabia was fomenting for a change and looking forward to a man of genius who would respond to it better than any other. Sir William Moir says, during the youth of Muhammad, this aspect of the peninsula was strongly conservative. Perhaps it was never at any period more hopeless. Reviewing the feeble stir created by Christianity and Judaism in the dark and deep ocean of Arabian paganism, Sir William Moir remarks, quote, "In fine, viewed thus in a religious aspect, the surface of Arabia had been now and then gently rippled by the feeble efforts of Christianity. The sterner influence of Judaism had been occasionally visible in the deeper and more troubled currents, but the tide of indigenous idolatry and of Ishmaelite superstitions, setting from every quarter with an unbroken, unebbing urge towards the Kaaba, gave ample evidence that the faith and worship of Makkah held the Arabs' mind in a rigorous and undisputed manner." Unquote. Bosworth Smith is another European biographer of the Prophet who had reached the same conclusion. Quote, "One of the most philosophical of historians had remarked that all the revolutions which have had a permanent influence upon the civil history of mankind, none could be so little as anticipated by human prudence as affected by the religion of Arabia. And at first sight, it must be confessed that the science of history, if indeed there be such a science, is at a loss to find the sequence of cause and effect which it is the objective and the test of all history, which is worthy of the name to trace it." Unquote. Need of a new prophet. The old world was completely disarranged by the middle of the 6th century, and a man had fallen to such a depth of depravity that no reformer, revivalist, or religious preacher could be hoped to put a new life in the humanity worn to its bones. The problem was not to fight any particular heresy or to reshape a given mode of divine service, nor the question was how to curb the social evils of any society, for there was never any dearth of social reformers or religious preachers in any age. How to clear the contaminating debris of idolatry and fetishes, superstitions and paganism, piling up from generations to generations during the past hundreds of years over the true teachings of the Prophet sent by God, was indeed a task exceedingly difficult. It was a Herculean task to make a clean sweep of this wreckage and raise a new nation on the foundations of piety and godliness. In short, the question was how to remake man who could think and feel differently from his predecessors as a changed man, reborn and brought back to life again. Quote, "Is he who was dead, and we have raised him unto life, and set for him a light wherein he walks amongst men, as him who is similitude is in its utter darkness when he cannot emerge, as is said in the Quran," unquote. In order to solve the problem of man once and for all, it was necessary to root out paganism so completely that no trace of it was left in the heart, to plant the saplings of monotheism so deeply that it should be difficult to conceive of a more secure foundation. It meant to create penchant for seeking the pleasure of God and humbling oneself before God, to bring into the existence the longing to serve humanity, to generate the will to keep always on the right path, and to sow the seeds of that moral courage which restrains all the evil passions and desires. The whole problem in a nutshell was how to rescue humanity, then to willingly commit suicide from the misery of this world as well as the next. It was an endeavor which makes a beginning in the form of a virtuous life like that of an elect and godly soul, and then leads on to paradise promised by God to those who are God-fearing and just. The advent of the Prophet was thus the greatest divine blessing of mankind on mankind by God. That is why it has been so elegantly quoted in the Quran, the words of God. Quote, "And remember Allah's favor unto you, how you were enemies, and he made friendship between your hearts, so that you may become as brothers by his grace, and how you were upon the brink of an abyss of fire, and he did save you from it," unquote. No task more delicate and baffling, and no charge more onerous and gigantic than that entrusted to Muhammad, peace be upon him, the apostle of God, was imposed on any man since the birth of man on this planet. And never had man accomplished such a huge and lasting revolution as the Prophet did, for he had guided millions of men of many nationalities to the path of justice, truth, and virtue by putting a new life in the humanity at the throes of death in the 6th century. It was the greatest marvel of human history, the greatest miracle the world had ever seen. The well-known French poet Lamartine bears witness to the grand accomplishments of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in a language of incomparable elegance and felicity. Quote, "Never has man set for himself, voluntarily or involuntarily, a more sublime aim, since this aim was superhuman, to subvert such superstitions which had been interposed between man and God, to render God unto man and man unto God, to restore the rational and sacred ideas of divinity amongst the chaos of material and disfigured gods of idols which were existing. Never has a man undertaken a work so far beyond human power with so feeble means, for he had in the conception as well as in the execution of such a great design no other instrument than his own self, and no other aid except for a handful of men living in a corner of a desert. And more than that, he moved the altars, he moved the gods, the religions, the ideas, the beliefs and souls, on the basis of a book, every letter of which has become a law. He created a spiritual nationality which blended together people of every race and every tongue. He has left us the characteristic of a Muslim nationality, the hatred of false gods, the passion for one and immaterial God, his avenging patronism against the profanation of heaven, formed the virtue of the followers of Muhammad, the conquest of one third of the world. To this dogma was his miracle, and rather it was not a miracle of a man, but that of reason, the idea of unity of God, proclaimed amongst the exhaustion of fables, was in itself such a miracle that upon its utterance from its lips, it destroyed all the ancient temples of idol and set fire to the false beliefs of one third of the world." Unquote. This universal and enduring revelation, whose objective was the rejuvenation of humanity or rebuilding of the world again, demanded a new prophet and prophethood surpassing the apostleship of the old, For the new prophet had to hold aloft the banner of divine guidance and righteousness for all the time to come. God has himself explained the reason for it. Quote, those who disbelieve amongst the people of the scripture and their idolaters could not have left off erring till the clear proof came unto them. A messenger from Allah reading purified pages containing corrected scriptures. Jazakallah khair. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.